Welcome to the program. When we think of war and the weapons of war, sometimes the weaponry often defines the conflict. From the musket, the monitor, and the Merrimack, to Fat Man and Little Boy, our weapons have defined our view of conflicts and how we see our own military preparedness. One such seminal weapon has been the AK-47. Designed in Russia after World War II, originally as the Kalashnikov, it became one of the most common weapons in the world and one of the most dominant. A weapon mass-produced and designed to inflict maximum harm at close range, it has been alternately seen as a gun of liberation and oppression. We're going to talk about this very particular gun today with my guest, C.J. Chivers. He's a senior writer for the New York Times, former Moscow bureau chief, as well as a frequent contributor to Esquire. He was an infantry officer in the U.S. Marines and served in the Gulf War and in the Los Angeles riots before being honorably discharged as a captain. His reporting has received numerous awards and prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for coverage for the New York Times of combat in Afghanistan. It is my pleasure to welcome C.J. Chivers here to talk about his new book, The Gun. C.J. Chivers, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. One of the things that comes across so powerfully is that this gun, this AK-47, in some ways feels as much a part of the Cold War as nuclear weapons do. That as you look at the history of it, it was so much a part of what we've experienced in terms of warfare over the past 60 years.
Yeah, in many ways, if you think about it, it's the quintessential product, maybe the most important invisible export of the Soviet Union. And because it's used in such dramatic ways, it leaves an impression that even goes beyond the extraordinary number of its output.
And part of that extraordinary number, as you talk about it, comes from the fact that unlike, for example, the M16 or any gun that would be produced in the West, that it wasn't determined by market forces, but the government of the Soviet Union at the time, Stalin, decided that simply hundreds of millions of these were going to be produced.
Well, it's you're gone right to the sort of heart of one of the attendant myths of the AK-47, which is all the things we know about it, and the conventional wisdom is that it works very well, therefore it's very abundant, as if, market forces pulled it out of the factories. But it really, that's a pretty keen misunderstanding, because this was hooked up to the planned economy. It was made in extraordinary numbers, literally in tens of millions, far larger numbers than there were soldiers in the standing armies of the Eastern Bloc. And this is the reason it's such a dominant weapon. If it had been made in a market economy, it would have been much less influential.
But the other part of it is that in spite of that, it worked pretty darn well, that its design, that its simplicity really made it a pretty effective weapon in so many respects.
All weapons or all rifles anyhow are compromises. If you want the rifle to do one thing, it probably can't do something else. And this rifle is the distillation of a set of very good choices on the pragmatics of weapon making. It's not very heavy. It's not very long, so it can be wielded by just about anyone who's healthy. It has little recoil, so it can even be wielded by the small statured. It's not a long-range weapon at all, but it lets people shoot at most of the ranges at which combat occurred, and they can shoot either automatically or with a flick of the lever, one shot at a time. So it does pretty much almost everything that you would want a rifle to do if you were an infantryman, a conventional conscript, not a highly skilled sniper. So it does work very well.
And as we found out, particularly in Vietnam with this weapon, it really worked pretty well. It didn't jam. It got water on it. It got sand in it. It still didn't jam. It worked pretty consistently.
Well, that's the whole other element, is not only was it designed well, but it was manufactured to standards that ensured that it would work very well in harsh environments. It has a very good protective finish inside and out. And so, in some ways, where it first had its large-scale international debut in Vietnam, a humid climate, in terrible conditions for war fighting, it was in some ways the perfect weapon for that environment, which also has led to some of its reputation, which it kind of became an instant and early legend, and still is.
Talk about its original design. It was based on a German idea originally.
Well, a German concept, yes. The great challenge for a firearms designer who wanted to make an automatic weapon that an individual could use instead of a team of soldiers, which is essentially how they had largely been used to that point, The great challenge was to have ammunition that would be smaller than the heavy cartridges that preceded the AK-47 and the German rifle of the 1940s. And it had to be sort of midway between a pistol round and a rifle round. And the Germans got there first. They used a weapon that was built around one of these cartridges on the Eastern Front in World War II. The Soviet Union captured some of the weapons, saw them immediately for what they were, as this compromise arm that would be very useful in many circumstances. And they copied the idea. The gun itself is not a direct part-by-part, you know, reverse-engineered knockoff. But the idea was a German one, and the Soviet Union has always been excellent, or always was excellent, at intelligence collection and grasping the significance of its enemy's materials. And it got its hands on this German weapon, and it made its own knockoff.
Talk about how the design has applied to people both that are skilled with guns and particularly those that have been unskilled in using them.
Well, a lot of people, think of, in simplest terms, two different types of soldiers on the battlefield. There's soldiers who come from countries like the one that we live in. And these soldiers tend to have, you know, they're literate, obviously, and they have a high set of technical skills, and they might, use a lot of electronics, and they might wrench on cars. And you can give them a fairly complicated rifle, and they can keep it working and use it well. But a lot of soldiers around the world don't fit that description. A lot of guerrillas, a lot of sort of combatants who come into war on short notice, whether they're children or jihadists or whatever role they're fulfilling in asymmetric war. And for these people, having a rifle that's very easy to use in the simplest sense speeds up training time and it makes them more effective quickly. And the AK-47 is very well designed, if you will, for the peasant army that the Red Army was fielding in the 1940s, and for all of these proxy forces that have followed since.
And, of course, it was sold, I mean, to the extent that it was sold, as kind of a gun of liberation. That's how the Soviets referred to it.
Well, the Soviet Union, you know, the Kremlin had an extraordinary propaganda machine. Propaganda is a pernicious thing, and it works in lasting ways. And once the gun was circulated, you know, once this rifle was made and pushed out, it had a lot of fables attached to it. One of them was what you just said, that it's the liberation gun. But the first uses, and one of its most enduring characteristic uses, is as a tool of oppression. This is the gun that the strong man turns against the crowd and has again and again and will in the future. This is, you know, this is the weapon of Tiananmen Square. And this liberation gun, that's a nice tale, but it certainly doesn't quite add up on the balance.
How was the gun pushed out there? How did it get so widely distributed?
Well, initially it was made as the standard shoulder arm for the Soviet conscripts and the soldiers of the Chinese army. And how did it get to the Chinese army? Well, Mao came looking to a like-minded state for technical assistance after the revolution. And Stalin passed along some initial technology, and Khrushchev sent along more. And pretty soon they were, you know, making weapons that would be compatible with the Soviet counterparts. And then came the Warsaw Pact, and one of the sort of little heralded provisions of the Warsaw Pact required standardization of all the Eastern Bloc armies. And this meant that they would all have the same rifle, and they almost all did very quickly have the AK-47. And because, again, these were planned economies, as factories opened up and tooled up, it became a sort of a socialist franchise to make these guns and to make them in quantities that the armies actually didn't need and stockpile them around fronts. And once they existed in these numbers, they began to move. Sometimes they were passed along as political favors, say to Egypt, or to a proxy force that might be harassing the West. And as their numbers grew, they started to move by capitalism. You know, people began to sell them like any other commodity. So one of the great ironies is the socialist weapon soon became the capitalist product, which is what it remains to this day. I mean, the biggest purchaser that we know of right now over the last 10 years has been the United States.
One of the things that happened in the late 50s, early 60s, as there was much talk at the time about a missile gap, was also a kind of rifle gap. That was when the M16 began to evolve. Talk about that period.
Well, after World War II, the United States retained its commitment to a more powerful, longer-range, heavier rifle, while the Soviet Union came out with this medium-powered, shorter-ranged automatic rifle. And these two ideas kind of existed in parallel for about 15 years until Vietnam came along. And in Vietnam, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army were fitted by the early 1960s and certainly by the mid-1960s with Kalashnikovs, many of them Chinese-made. And the American M14, which was a heavier rifle, in the jungle environment, was not a match for the AK-47. It just couldn't put out as much fire as quickly. And the United States quickly realized this, and it rushed into, you know, its troops' hands a weapon that was essentially a reaction to the AK-47. The weapon was the M16. M16 today is a very good rifle. I carried one for years in the Marine Corps. But in its early phases, it hadn't been debugged, just had not been worked out. The troops were almost literally carrying a prototype out there. It had many technical problems. It was prone to failure. The Pentagon covered up these problems. I mean, the memos exist that show this cover-up in plain language. They've been declassified since. And it was a real agonizing experience for the troops in 66, 67, into 68 even, who had rifles that really were not yet ready for war.
They jammed frequently.
They tended to seize up. They would jam. And this had probably many causes all working together, but one of them was that the rifle did not have the corrosion resistance that it needed. And inside the rifle, it would pit and rust, and a spent cartridge after the bullet had flown out of the muzzle, the cartridge casing that remained behind tended to get stuck. And that meant a second cartridge could not be loaded behind. And this is kind of a very bad jam to have, because it takes a lot of time to clear and to get the weapon in a position to work again. And in a firefight, you might not have that time.
And the weapon itself, the M16, was never fully tested. In fact, some of the testing that was done was a little bit sketchy and, as you say, was covered up by the Pentagon because they were embarrassed about some of the things they were doing.
There's two problems with the development cycle of the weapon. One was it certainly was not adequately tested. It did not go through the full development cycle. And because it was so new, the AK-47, which was out there on the other side, was a much more mature product that had been refined over 15 years. The M16, as we said, was rushed. And one of the things they did when they rushed was, in a matter of weeks after Secretary of Defense McNamara wrote a memo in which he worried aloud that the communist forces had better weapons, was they had to test on what they called relative lethality. And relative lethality is a hard thing to measure, you know, which weapon's more deadly than the other. And to test this, they got together a bunch of heads, human heads, that were removed from cadavers, apparently shipped into the country from India, and they shot these heads at different ranges with different rifles and different bullets at different angles. And they also shot a bunch of legs that they dismembered from cadavers as well. And then they tried to determine which rifle was more dangerous or lethal than the others at various ranges. The tests were a sham. They were rushed. There were no observers. There was no peer review. And no sooner had the results of these tests begun to percolate around the top ranks of the Pentagon than the Pentagon essentially became horrified. It smothered these tests. It restricted their circulation, you know, reflexively and fiercely. And it was just another example of this, you know, essentially this gross mismanagement of the process that was going to be giving American soldiers the most fundamental tool of war.
One of the other things you write about is the degree to which the AK-47 is now so much a part of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, again, it goes to the numbers. There's so many of them out there that they've entered the martial and even the social fabric of many countries. And in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've certainly entered the social fabric. And there's so many of them, in fact, that the United States initially tried to disarm both countries. It gave that up quickly. You know, in the United States, the United States military in Iraq had reached the decision by 2006 that Iraq could not be disarmed, and that actually taking the Kalashnikovs away from families when they did house searches and the like did nothing but perhaps make the families more vulnerable to everybody else who had them. And so there became a policy where it was one AK-47, or they're not really AK-47s now, but one Kalashnikov per house was allowed as a matter of American policy in Iraq. And it was, I remember doing patrols then and going into these houses with Marines and soldiers and just feeling that if there ever was an indicator of how many of them there were out there, this was it.
And do we have a sense of how many are out there in terms of literal numbers?
No. This weapon was made by the most secretive governments, right. Some of the most secretive governments the world has ever known. The archives haven't been opened. Many of the governments that have distributed the weapons, including ours, don't have a strong incentive to talk about how many they've bought and who they've given them to, or how many they've made and where they've distributed them, or even how many remain in some of the stockpiles in, say, Russia or China or Ukraine. It is possible through sort of analysis and deduction to take a pretty good estimate by looking at replacement cycles of weapons and standing sizes of the militaries that carry them. And the people who've done that have said that maybe as many as 100 million have been made to date, and more are being made each year.
And is there a difference between the one, much of a difference between the ones being made today and the ones 60 years ago?
Fundamentally, no. I mean, the guts, if you will, of a Kalashnikov are the guts of a Kalashnikov. But there have been many other changes. And you should think of the Kalashnikov at this point as kind of a platform built around those guts. And each country has made different variants. And the biggest change came 10 years into the line. You know, in 1959, when the solid steel Kalashnikov was replaced by one of stamped metal, this lightened up the weight, and there were other small changes as well. But that line, the Kalashnikov line that is made with the stamped metal, is by far the more abundant. But they all basically work the same way, and with some exceptions, many of their parts are interchangeable, which is another reason that a country that gets armed up with Kalashnikovs tends to have them something like in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. There's also the sense that everybody has one, that it's like every man's gun.
Well, in the places where they're abundant, that's you certainly do get that feel. And there are, entire regions of many countries that are kind of off the grid in terms of services, that the government can provide, in terms of a climate of law enforcement that the government might provide. Because there are so many actors out there in the field carrying these around.
If there were ever a desire on the part of nations to do something to stop the proliferation, is it too late? Is there anything that could be done, do you think?
Well, sure, there's things that can be done. I think that experience tells us that most disarmament programs don't work very well. If you go and sit in on some of these things, what you find is, let's say you do a $50 gun buyback around the world. You do it anywhere. You do that here in the town where I live, or you do that in Kabul, and most of what you end up getting are busted guns. Collecting them from people who don't want to give them up is a patrol-by-patrol, fight-by-fight experience. It's not a very efficient process either. But longer term, the way to perhaps reduce the proliferation is to make sure that the remaining stockpiles are well contained. It's the slippage out of the state arsenals into the hands of people who do no good with these weapons. That's the real problem. Once they get out, though, they last decades. And so the weapons that are out there, the way they're really going to go away is they're going to break one by one over time. Most of them are not going to be collected. And you know what else? Often when they are collected, and I've seen this too, a military force will pick them up, and it'll hold on to them for a little while, and it'll give them back out to someone else, to a friend of the moment. So they tend to come in one door and go out the side door. There hasn't been a lot of will in many places to destroy them. And the destruction of, piece by piece of weapons out there is an errand that often leads to little result.
And how have they stacked up in Iraq and Afghanistan against the M16 as kind of a pushback to them?
Well, we're in a entirely different experience than what Vietnam was like for the soldiers then. There's two reasons. One is that these climates are arid and they tend not to have a lot of vegetation, as is common without water. And so in places that don't have a lot of vegetation, combat ranges often stretch out. This is, in the simplest sense, in a lot of places to hide. and people, many firefights in Afghanistan are at several hundred meters or more. In this situation, the Kalashnikov's not the best weapon. And so it's not as effective against American troops. The second reason is that the current line of the M16 and the M4 carbine are incomparably better than the weapons that were initially issued. I mean, they're now mature, they're now debugged. They work pretty well. They have modern rail systems and optics and night sights. And so in many cases, the Americans in a firefight will have a pretty good standoff against people with Kalashnikovs. But I like to remind everyone that that's not the measure. How the weapon works against the most, you know, fully resourced army on Earth is not the Kalashnikov's true measure. It's how it works against the vulnerable. It's how it works against civilians. It's how it makes weak governments weaker in the areas where the governments can't have its influence. It's how it enables human rights abuses to occur on a larger scale. It's how it gets used by repressive governments against, you know, demonstrators like at Tiananmen Square. These are the measures. How it stands up now against the United States, well, the United States' reaction to the Kalashnikov is now half a century old, and I would say they've more than caught up.
It has also become the gun of choice, as we've talked about, in the Third World. I mean, that's where its proliferation is the greatest.
Well, it's for the same reasons we described. Remember, right. You know, Team A and Team B being perhaps less sophisticated than Team A. And there's also the issue of price. You know, the Kalashnikovs get made in such numbers that they can be purchased now at the wholesale level for a fraction of the cost of a newly manufactured Western, you know, assault rifle. So they tend to get purchased in small bulk by proxy forces and you know, guerrilla units, or, you know, guerrilla armies in the field. I mean, you can get them for, you know, wholesale for $200 a piece or less, and that's air delivered. And a new, you know, a new Western equivalent, you know, might cost you $1,000.
What have we seen in Africa in terms of the proliferation of them?
Well, you know, AK, right? The AK-47, we call it. The AK in Africa is often known as the Africa killer. I mean, I think that sort of summarizes the view of many of the people who have had their communities, influenced by this weapon. I had a guy from Ethiopia come up to me the other day when I was speaking, and he shook my hand and said, you know, I thank you for writing this book. This weapon ruined my country.
C.J. Chivers, the book is The Gun. I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.